Hey everybody, welcome to The Checkout. You know where to get it, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, always hosted on our homepage at checkoutjazz.org. I'm Simon Rentner. And on today's show, well, we're very excited about it. We're bringing you to Brooklyn Rough Trade for the album release party of Mark Juliana's Beat Music, the name of his latest Motema offering. The drummer and composer is known for his chameleon-like ways with pulse, whether he's leading his acoustic jazz quartet, playing a duo with pianist Brad Meldow, or famously giving David Bowie that backbeat on his final recording, Black Star. But now Juliana is in another mutation mode, shifting his focus away from his acoustic projects to something a bit more electric. And that's what we're going to bring you today, his concert album release party of Beat Music at Rough Trade with Nick Simrad on synth, along with Big Yuki, Chris Morrissey on electric bass, and of course, our guest of today, Juliana. And we captured video of this entire performance, so you must watch it. That's right, go to npr.org/jazznight. And here we go. Here's Roast by Mark Juliana's Beat Music at Rough Trade.
Exist.
Beat music. Maybe I should shout it from a mountaintop. It does have exclamation points. Mark Juliana drops his latest album on Motema, and we're bringing you concert material from Rough Trade right before you go on this pretty ambitious European tour. Beat music has been around, brewing, fermenting, once in your parents' basement. Here we are 10 years later, and it still feels like a coming out party.
You really don't know how it's going to feel until it happens to you.
In some ways, yes. I think this record is definitely the most realized version of the band. With that being said, I don't think we could have arrived here without the journey of the last 10 years. I think the biggest difference is that the majority of the band's life has relied heavily on improvisation. This community of musicians are really my favorite musicians, and I really think they're masters of their craft, and I'm always learning from them and have learned so much from them. And all of those experiences have led to this new batch of music, which interestingly doesn't really feature improvisation in that traditional way. So it was my first attempt at creating this through composed material and then presenting it to the guys later to be recorded and documented. It's important that I state that I'm still heavily relying on their musicianship and friendship and their interpretations of the compositions. It wasn't until they got their hands on it that the music really came alive.
Well, let's take you to the show that we recorded on April 12th at Rough Trade, the newest installment of Mark Juliana's Beat Music.
Thank you.
Beat music on Motema is the commercial release. However, we are bringing you the concert release party from Rough Trade here with Mark Juliana and speaking with him in New Jersey. You're a Jersey boy. Jersey has always been a big part of your life, but not going to be that way in the near future.
Maybe not in a material way, but it will always be my center for sure. But yes, I'm heading west this summer with my family, and we'll see what that brings.
Which is your dominant personality, the acoustic or the electric?
Both the acoustic and the electronic sides of my brain are of equal significance and equal value to me. So really, I'm ducking the question a little bit, but I think I'm just so grateful that I have an outlet for each.
Do you remember a time where you tried to smash two styles and ideas together that went horribly wrong?
Well, I wouldn't say horribly wrong. I'd say maybe not horribly right either. But I'm proud of all the smashing together of influences that I've done over time. You know, I could think back to certain late nights in college playing with my friends where it was like maybe what was coming through the rehearsal room door was a mess, but it was exciting and we were learning a lot about what it means to make music and the taking chances. And
is there a scene that sticks out in your mind?
No.
Okay.
I'll stand by all of it.
Yeah. Well, not that it goes horribly wrong, but just an interesting moment of a collision of things. Like, let's do this. Let's put Nirvana on top of, you know, Elvin Jones and see if that works.
I'm still trying to do that now. That sounds great to me.
Who is this keyboardist we're listening to?
So this is Nick Semrod, and I think in some ways bringing Nick into this community is a perfect transition to the next steps of always keeping our mind open for new possibilities and new collaborators. He's a great example of a musician and particularly a keyboard player that is a rare breed. And of course, Jason Lindner is a part of this rare breed, and Big Yuki and Jeff Babko, the three guys who are on the record. Maybe it's not so difficult to find a keyboardist that has a really strong connection to improvising in the traditional sense, right? And then there's a long list of the guys that really know the ins and outs of more of the synth world, but it's a much shorter list of the guys who can do both. That is the perfect candidate for the beat music world because it relies just as heavily on the knowledge of sounds and crafting new sounds and improvising that way as it does, you know, dealing with the, you know, musically as well and being able to interact and kind of go anywhere at any time.
Unmentionables be mentioned before all of our panties are in one giant, ambigalactic, unisexualistic, gender-lost, lava and gridiron, ice cream, Saturday brunchin, luncheon, brunch. Thank you.
Mark Juliana joins us here on the Checkout on Jazz Night in America. Beat music on Motema. Just came out April 12th, and we're bringing you music from the album release party at Rough Trade. All right, let's go back to this idea of community, though. You just said this about beat music being a communal affair. That's the way jazz was back in the day, right? At like Mittens, when Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk were working out all these ideas. It really felt like a community creating the language together. I guess this is a two-part question. Does that even exist in jazz now? Or if it does exist in jazz, is this the latest manifestation of it?
You know, optimistically, I'd say absolutely. The only way we can move the music forward is as a community. You know, it's very rare that one person has all the ideas, you know, and tells everybody else what to do and how to behave. I think even in this case where it's quote unquote my music, it's absolutely, as I hand it over, I am in need of everyone's individual interpretation and them injecting their own personality into the parts, really choosing the sounds that they think is best. I would be an insane person, you know, to hand some parts over and tell them what I think is best on their instrument, the instrument that they've spent their entire life developing a relationship with, you know? So it's with humility that I hand Jason Lindner a chart, or I hand, you know, Chris Morrissey a chart, or Big Yuki, whoever these, you know, I am excited for them to, in a moment's notice, you know, make the decisions that they know will be best for the music.
Let's explicitly look at the material that you are calling through composed as it pertains to this music that we're listening to today. This approach to improvisation that isn't the standard way that jazz players improvise. You've described it as microscopic.
So on this recording, there isn't the improvisation in the traditional sense that we might think of. Whereas there's a form that the musician will, you know, play a solo over. I think we could agree on a fairly standard definition of improvising, or creating something from nothing, right? But that does not mean there isn't a great deal of improvising on the recording. So when I mentioned the improvising being on a more microscopic level, that could be if I hand Stu Brooks, one of the bass players on the record, I say, okay, here's the part. And it is through composed, it's a part. But at every moment, he's making his own choices. Less so about what notes to play, because that's what the information the part gives him. But it's more about sound and duration, articulation, feel, where things belong, adding a note here, removing a note here. And although it's still a premeditated part, it's still very alive in that moment and true to him. Personal relationships are extremely important to me, and I really feel like they make their way into the music. So it's a combination of trusting the relationship and also really being fans of these musicians and knowing that trying to leave the door open as much as possible for them to make their own decisions, albeit within this slightly more confined environment.
Everything you just told me about the kind of freedom that you not only allow but encourage with your bandmates to illustrate their individual personalities and genius on their instruments that they've been studying their whole life. That whole concept sounds like jazz to me.
I think you're right. The spirit from which we're playing is jazz, sure. You know, every time I sit down, it's jazz, whether it is or not. But you know, I don't think it's wrong for people to not identify this sound, the timbre, as jazz. But to me, I'm happy with, if people listen to it, that's the first step. And then if they choose to describe it with words, that's another step. And whatever words they choose, that's fine. But for me, you're right in the sense that the spirit is coming from that place. Celebrating the individual personalities while trying to deliver the most unified group message.
At Rough Trade, your bassist for the evening is Chris Morrissey. What defines this Chris Morrissey bass line that you have written for him? For Bullet, for instance.
So in the song Bullet, it's one of the more involved songs on the album. Over the years, Chris Morrissey and I have played a lot together. He's probably the musician I've played with the most over the last 5 or 6 years. And there have been times, whether it's with the jazz quartet or previous versions of beat music, where I've asked him to learn some difficult music. And he always comes through, always. He's one of the most prepared musicians I know. He's a hungry practicer and preparer. His MO, he doesn't want to read music on stage. He's a memorizer, all these things. He's really a luxurious band member to have. So when I was working on Bullet, it was like, okay, you know, yeah, it's Chris. He's got it. And I sent it along, and he had some choice words for me. not all positive.
Can you paraphrase?
Well, he was like, this can't be played. Something to that degree. And I said, come on, man. You got it. And, you know, in a couple weeks, it's there.
And what was impossible about the chart?
You know, when I was writing the melodic material, I'm ignorant to how it will land on the neck of the bass. So I asked him to play a certain melody that you can hear in the song. And he just said it's not very intuitive. Like, he wouldn't ever think to make those kinds of moves. So he just had to teach his muscles a couple different paths.
Having watched this band, your various performances at Rockwood Music Hall, which I guess replaced your parents' basement for your workshop platform. And I was always just trying to figure out, like, what is going on? Which must have been the same kind of experience that people had when they first saw, like, Ornette Coleman, or when they first saw some of the jazz players in these really important periods where it's like, what's really happening? And how are they achieving this? How does it sound so structured and free at the same time?
I think quite a lot of this music has been generated from just completely improvised performances. And it's in those moments where, of course, listening is the only thing that matters, you know, especially when we're improvising. Awareness of the moment is number one. The element that I think about a lot, that the muscle that I've had to strengthen the most in improvised situations, is the idea of dedicated, intentional repetition. If you ask someone to play whatever they want, just anything you want, just go. It's not the intuitive choice to play one thing over and over with great intention and passion. Quite often, repetition is born of someone giving you instructions. You say, okay, drummer, here's your part. Play that for 4 minutes. But I think in an improvised situation, first instinct is, wow, I get to do whatever I want. I'm just going to try a bunch of different stuff. And one of the things that suffers is a structure. And a great way to build structure is through repetition. But I think the biggest clarification has to be the intention of that repetition. If I'm playing the same beat over and over, say, you know, one measure of a groove, instead of just saying, I'm going to play this beat for the next 4 minutes, it's every time that beat is about to come back to the beginning, I'm choosing again to play it. At any moment, I can choose to not play it. We're not making these blanket decisions like, okay, here's the music for the next 4 minutes. It's at every moment we are reaffirming that choice and choosing to do it again. Also, I think the discipline with which we stay on certain parts is actually very seductive within the band, actually. Maybe that's a silly word, but it's very contagious. So if I'm playing something and I'm clearly not moving, I am really just playing this one thing over and over and over, Chris is going to listen and be like, oh, he's not moving. Okay, I'm just going to stay here. And then Yuki's going to be like, wow, these guys aren't moving. I guess I should just stay here. And that's really without having to talk about those kinds of choices, that's where the stuff can really start to move. Thank you.
We're here listening to live music from Mark Giuliana's Beat Music album release party at Rough Trade. Beat music, beat music, beat music. I had to say it once kind of loud. What you are describing, Mark Giuliana, to me, is what I hear on the Blue Note catalog from 1958 to 1965. That essence where no one is overplaying, everyone is playing the right amount, and the synergy seems perfect, like it could be a through composed piece.
Yeah, I think sometimes I listen to the way a rhythm section behaves underneath a soloist, and if the feeling is incredible, the groove is incredible, and the sound is there, I never wish there was more interaction. Because why would I wish for anything to potentially disrupt the feeling that they've created? There is something magical about creating a foundation and just really investing in that. Another really interesting thing is that if someone does choose to leave where they've been, a very important option to recognize is to not react. I think another maybe a stereotypical characteristic of jazz is the heightened sense of interaction. It's absolutely one of the things I love most about the music. But at times, maybe it can be abused, that sense of interaction. Sometimes so much so where everyone's reacting to everything and maybe the foundation diminishes. So by acknowledging a change but not literally reacting could really be as powerful as reacting, or more powerful.
I love talking about this because I can't imagine these insights and words of wisdom that you are speaking right now have ever come from a jazz school, or have they? Have you heard these lessons in jazz school?
I haven't. I wouldn't rule out, there are some incredible teachers out there, so I wouldn't rule it out, but for me, these realizations can only come from your own experiences.
I'm taking sort of a temperature or a pulse of seeing what's happening in innovative waves in the realm of jazz. You know, I see what people are doing in LA, of course, where you're moving. What I see Makaya McRaven is doing in Chicago. What Shabaka Hutchings is doing in the UK scene. I see you within this dialogue with these other scenes as you are working on this language.
I love New York. There's no reason to leave for any artistic reason. Everyone that you mentioned, of course they can all play, of course they're all very, very strong musicians, but I think when I hear the names you're mentioning and the reason you're mentioning them, it's concept. You know, of course it gets to a point where everybody can play And then when you get all those people in the room, then it's like, who do I want to hear play? You know, and why do you want to hear them play? And that doesn't mean that I don't love a very strong soloist or virtuosic performances. But again, of who you mentioned, I really think about, it's like they're carving out some real estate conceptually. And, you know, the sound is so important. The same way that you have separated them by geographically, in my mind, it's like, oh, Shabaka, I saw him 2 weeks ago in the city and we hung out. Went to the Comet Is Coming show and then we had a couple drinks after. So I actually don't see those lines between any of those things. I think you're right to, it's easy to say, to group it that way. But to me, it really feels like one big community.
Do you also see that these jazz players are embracing technology in a way, in ways that others aren't? And do you feel as though this is still a roadblock as it concerns the larger jazz community?
Technology is always a touchy subject, but it's interesting on the subject of Shabaka and his projects. When I saw Comet Is Coming at the Mercury Lounge, Dan, the keyboard player, was playing a Juno, some Roland synth that I had never heard of. And I was like, man, what's that synth? He's like, oh, it's just the first one I got for like £200 15 years ago. So here we are thinking, oh, wow, this is this super progressive next, you know, here they're incorporating technology. But, you know, it's just, these are instruments that have been around for a while. I was like, wow, what is that synth? Why did it hit me in that way? It's because his relationship with that specific instrument. And that's what we have to remember is the instrument, that keyboard is no different than a saxophone in the sense that it won't create any sound without someone pulling the sound out of it. I don't know, maybe there was a time when the saxophone was invented that there was pushback, that was considered technology. I'd have to do some research. But I think electronic instruments or something like a drum machine, you know, there's the bumper sticker you see sometimes that drum machines have no soul. Well, that's irrelevant. I don't agree with that, but that's, that point is irrelevant. It's who is the one in charge of that machine? And are they communicating their spirit through it? And if not, then the machine has no soul because the person isn't injecting a soul, you know? But, you know, when I think about someone like Square Pusher or Aphex Twin or these masters, to me, that's John Coltrane is being communicated through a saxophone.
Take us to one Square Pusher song from your ears, Mark Juliana's ears. What are you listening for? What are you hearing that you think is so great? And translate it for us.
The first Square Pusher record that I heard is Feed Me Weird Things. And the first song on that record is called Square Pusher Theme. I will never forget, being handed a blank CD by my friend at college where he wrote Square Pusher, Feed Me Weird Things on it. And I put it on. I had no idea what was happening in that moment, but it hit me in a way that I knew I had to learn more about this music. And that track in particular, one of the things that really grabbed me is, although he's playing everything, it's built in a way that's not so different from a band. Drums, bass and kind of guitar or keys, because he's a bass player, so he's playing all the bass stuff, and I'm sure some of those bass things could be interpreted as guitar or something, higher elements, chordal things. And then the drums, as far as I could tell, is just, you know, chopped up samples. But I really don't know. Part of the appeal about this music for me is that mystery. We'll be right back. it's really exciting and humbling and scary to put on a record that I've listened to for 20 years and still not know what's going on. But that's why that music for me is a very reliable source of inspiration.
Mark Juliana, thanks so much for spending some time with us and talking about beat music, your process, your future, your European tour that's going to be rigorous, but I'm sure incredibly fulfilling. And as you continue to explore the musical personalities of your band, Nick Simrad, Big Yuki, Chris Morrissey, and the whole beat music community. Thank you for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And we'll leave you today with Mark Juliana's performance of Human.
creation, not one can claim more lifelong devotees than
Human, Mark Juliana, wrapping up his concert at Rough Trade on April 12th. That music can be found on Beat Music, Beat Music, Beat Music on Motema as well. And if you like the music on today's show, well, you know, you can watch it as a concert video, a concert film that you can see at npr.org/jazznight, or you can just go to our page, check out jazz.org, and find the link there as well. And of course, we're a podcast. You can get it where you get your podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher. All of our shows are archived on our homepage at checkoutjazz.org. And make sure to follow us on social media, The Checkout from WBGO on Facebook at Checkout Jazz. I'm at Simon Rettner on Instagram. That's me, your host, giving everyone at NPR Music a huge special thanks for making this concert capture possible. That's you, Colin Marshall. And also you, David Tallickson from WBGO, for your fabulous audio mix. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.